Blog Talk Radio.
Well, here we go, ladies and gentlemen, across the airwaves. It's a Saturday morning. It's that time again. We started out strong. It's a Doc Talk podcast hosted by a brother, a mentor, and a friend to me, Dr. Greg Roscoe, out there in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Yours truly, Mark Mancini, producing this live from Los Angeles. 347-205-9631. Goes by quick. If you miss it, catch the archive. No problems. blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports Podcast Platforms. Wherever you subscribe to podcasts, powered now by Mancini Media. So without further ado, as I lay that red carpet down, put the podium in its place, hand off the mic. First of all, Doc, how are you? Second of all, how can people get a hold of you? And third of all, we got a nice topic to talk about today.
We do. Mark, thanks again for the super introduction. I'm doing fine. Things are going well. You know, just here in Pittsburgh, we're kind of getting into that fall winter. It's in the 50s, a little gloomy, a little wet out, but it's getting chilly. The trees are changing, but it is a beautiful time of year, but you need a jacket. The listeners can get a hold of me at GJRMD308@outlook.com. You know, Mark, with regard to our topic today, I've had a couple of patients recently that have had upper airway infections and very serious problems, life-threatening. And I thought our listeners may be interested in listening to that. You know, there's two entities that we see that can cause very serious harm and even death if not caught quick enough. And the two entities I want to talk about, number one is something called epiglottitis, but the other entity is angioedema of the upper airway. You know, having said all that, Mark, I had quite a busy week with emails, by the way, from our listeners on the Keith Thorney show that we had last week.
Yeah.
And do you know what? You know how we brought up the topic about micromanagement in
right.
the NFL or in general? Should someone be out there taking, in a sense, away our freedoms? Or should they go ahead and they be very restrictive? And, again, I don't want to open that up this early in the broadcast, but it was interesting that I had many, many, many emails that suggested people don't want micromanagement. They want to be able to make decisions. Sometimes the decisions are good for us, good for our health, and occasionally they're not. And, you know, that kind of goes into the area of the smoking, the chewing, the alcohol a bit, Mark, and even into drugs. You know, people, again, we love freedom. And, again, I think freedom is an outstanding situation that we have in this country. But I think we need to taper it a little bit with responsibility. And, you know, I think we had listeners that suggested the NFL should really micromanage that tobacco use. And I think Keith was of the opinion that, you know, overall, you know, we want freedoms. You know, we'll take responsibility, but we like to have our freedom and our personal freedom to make decisions. Do you recall that, Mark?
Yes, and we're getting a lot of people commenting on that Keith Thorney interview. I know it was one of your highest shows, and boy, what a show that was. I'll get into that. George coming in here, a first-time caller, coming in from Santa Barbara, said you guys are talking about the neck pains and everything, and a CAT scan showed a calcification of an artery that was the main teller. He had 98% clogged artery called the Widowmaker, prevented a major heart attack. But he said the squeezing in the neck and the shoulders and the left arm every time it worked out was one of the main reasons. Wow, I never heard of a Widowmaker like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's correct. And, you know, we're talking about using that term, the widowmaker, that has to do with the circulation of the arteries to the heart muscle. And it's one of the large arteries in the heart that overall, if that does get occluded, the heart muscle can fail. We then get a myocardial infarction, and that can lead to cardiac failure and death. You know, with regard to, now I'm not a cardiologist, but, you know, overall my expertise is a little different. But indeed, if our patients are experiencing the chest pain, chest tightness, pain down the left arm or into the neck area, there are quite a few indications cardiac. So indeed, if one's experiencing that, it's a good time then to get yourself to, you know, one of your providers, get to the emergency room and be evaluated. And now I mentioned, he mentioned that he may have had surgery or he had something done. And usually, you know, it can be a bypass that will go ahead and take care of that and help maintain the circulation to the cardiac muscle. The other thing
James,
he was talking about.
Sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, you can finish that one because I'm getting a load of comments coming in.
All right. Well, we'll be glad to. He mentioned about calcification in his carotid artery. You know, there's arteries. Our anatomy is such that, you know, we have our heart. We have in the left chest, which is our pump. We then have the aorta, which is the major artery coming out of the heart. We then have, the term is carotid artery. There is one on the left and one on the right. The carotid arteries supply blood to our neck, our head, our brain, our face. Indeed, if one is having difficulties or getting calcifications there, that can lead to a stroke, which affects, again, you know, our major organ, which is the brain. So indeed, you know, these things today can be remedied, but indeed they need to be diagnosed early and then the appropriate treatment administered. So if one is starting to have symptoms that things aren't working right, they aren't thinking as well, their speech is slurred, the vision has changed, my right arm is numb or left arm is numb, we have to think about maybe there's a blockage in our circulation system. So go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, that brings up some interesting things. James from Warren, Ohio is a regular listener. He basically says, well, the CAT scan on an oral with the chalk would look at the abdomen, correct? So that would look at all the arteries.
Well, it can. Now, if we're
right.
talking, you know, again, just for definition, if he's talking about the substance and then having a CAT scan, we're looking at the loops of intestine, all right, for tumor, for blockage, for leakage, if that's what the gentleman's referring to. If, on the other hand, and I think you've heard the term dye or contrast,
right,
where you would have an IV, the dye is then put into your veins, and then you're having a CAT scan, then correct. We're looking for a blockage in our circulation system. Do you think that clarifies things a little bit, Mark?
I think it does. Barry coming in from Cranston, Rhode Island, says, Doc, every week, I love this show, man. You give us some in-depth. Talking about retainers, he didn't wear his retainer for a while, tried to put it in. He feels like it shrunk. They told him to keep it in water so it doesn't fit. Does he need a new retainer, or can they open that up as far as maybe a dentist goes? Wow, that's
sure.
Another great question.
Another great question. Thank you, Mark. Very good. You know, as far as a retainer, this gentleman, again, I get very limited history. However, a retainer is the term is orthodontic appliance. It is something that's made. May have a plastic element like a denture part. Again, I don't know if it's on the top or on the bottom. but along with that acrylic or plastic part, there are usually wires. The wires that are molded for models and then fit to go ahead and to limit the motion of the dental arch or the teeth. So that potentially he's had orthodontic work to straighten his teeth, and again, the retainer's in to maintain the position of them. Usually during the day, you don't wear it. You put it in water just to keep it from drying out. And then, of course, at night, you can put it in. Now, again, it depends on what your orthodontist or dentist strategizes with you. But currently, I may think he has not worn it. So that overall, if he's finding it's fitting, could be a couple of things. Maybe the retainer has dried out. Possibly there's been movement of his teeth in his mouth. Thirdly, maybe he has somehow bent it, that overall the dynamics of the wiring have changed. So I think the easy solution is let's get back to the orthodontist or to the dentist, have them take a look at it. Maybe it's a matter of the dentist taking a very fine needle nose pliers, readjusting things, and then popping that thing back in. That's what it sounds like, Mark.
Yeah, and you know what? He's basically commenting on it, too. He basically says you might be right, not wearing it, but keeping it in water from it shrinking. That's what he was told, but not wearing it for quite a while. He probably figured he could just put it in, but maybe the teeth shifted it, and it's at the bottom, he says. So that's where the problem lies.
Yeah, and, you know, as far as that's called our mandibular teeth, and again, on the bottom, it probably is to keep the alignment and realize, I mean, you know, we all think that our teeth are fixed. Teeth are a little bit dynamic. There can be some motion, all right? Especially if you have a missing tooth, teeth will shift. So it is something, you're correct, Mark, that overall he may need to wear it, maybe a little more ongoing maintenance to keep things straight and to keep his dental areas healthy. You know, with regard to that point, if teeth move and they shift and there are missing teeth, teeth tend to go ahead and start to drift, and the drifting can be a definite issue. So I think he needs a little bit of maintenance. Let's get back to the dentist. Let's readjust it, and then maybe sit with the dentist or the dental professional and have them give you more specifics on the use of this thing and what needs to be done to fix the problem permanently.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hopefully they can save his retainer. Otherwise, he says it'll cost them $485.
Boy, he's absolutely right. And we know dentistry is very expensive, and indeed, it is still a very important part of our health care. We want to keep our teeth. We want to keep them healthy. And again, you know, the teeth help maintain our facial appearance, but more importantly, they help chew our food so that overall, when we're digesting, it helps the digestive process in our mouth before it gets to our stomach. Okay?
Yep. Gail from Clearwater, Florida, coming in, basically says, what's more important to check on a regular basis, the high blood pressure or the cholesterol levels? Wow. I didn't even think of that one.
Boy, that's a...
She's a regular on your show.
I know that. Yep. She called in last week as well.
Yep.
You know, Gail, we're talking about potential problems. It all depends on the severity of the problem. You know, are we talking about a small increase in blood pressure that could be labeled, you know, hypertension or high blood pressure? Are we talking a 5% increase in our cholesterol? So, you know, the scope is so important as to what these numbers mean. Ideally, you know, with your health and your health care, you would like your providers and professionals to try to control as many problems as possible. Ideally, you know, hypertension, if not controlled, which is high blood pressure, could lead to a stroke in your brain. You know, it could basically, because the blood flow is very fast, very powerful, it could break off little plaques in our arteries that then, of course, lodge in the brain and then leads to, you know, something called a CVA or a cardiovascular attack or a TIA, a transient ischemic attack, because of decreased circulation to the brain. And your brain needs an awful lot of oxygen to work. When it doesn't, those areas that are involved malfunction. So we need to control your blood pressure. Number two, the cholesterol. Cholesterol, again, is the fatty element in our blood. We need to keep that under control also because, again, the greasier our blood is, if I can use that term and you're understanding what I'm talking about, it tends to lead to the small arteries getting clogged, particularly in our brain. And, you know, again, we know about a stroke. We know about decreased oxygenation to the brain because it's a highly vascular organ and is constantly metabolizing. You know, there are small arteries in our spine as well that can get clogged. We can also, you know, if you want to use the term stroke, we also can get a stroke in our spine, meaning that we also can get damaged nerve tissue that is not getting circulation because the small arteries are blocked. So, Gail, you know, it's a matter, it's like getting a whole program. Let's take good care of you. Let's make sure all those numbers look good. Let's make sure, Gail, that, again, we're going and doing the treatment plan. You know, Gail, you're down in Clearwater. It's beautiful. Hopefully you're out walking every day, maybe riding a bicycle. Please be safe. And again, you're eating, you know, veggies and fruits. And again, your diet is well controlled. And again, I'm not sure if you have other health problems, but indeed, you know, we need to be responsible for our health. So let's manage the high blood pressure, let's manage the cholesterol, and let's put together a life-sustaining program. And hopefully that's not a long-winded answer, Mark, but we want to control as many factors as possible.
Well, you bring up an interesting point on what you commented to her on and everything, because you and I have talked about the cholesterol, and mine was up there. And then when I got mine checked recently, it went down to 128, I think, over 85. So I guess when you look at the cholesterol numbers, the bottom one is the better one, because I think mine was above 100 you know, a few months ago, but it's been just plenty of walking and water and stuff like that, and maybe sure, that's a good thing, too. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
My thoughts are, Mark, I think you're referring to blood pressure. You know, when we talk about blood pressure, and again, I don't want to say normal. Normal changes for many different aspects, but at one time, we were looking at 120 over 80 as normal blood pressure.
Right.
And again, the 120 is our systolic, and then the resting is called diastolic. So that's kind of where we'd like to be. And again, the thinking about blood pressure is you want to get enough circulation to the brain, and you want the heart to pull back the blood to the heart so it doesn't stay in our legs or our extremities. So, indeed, that's the purpose of your blood pressure, and that tells us the health of our pump. And our pump is our heart. So, again, the lower that number on the bottom within range is better. And, again, the lower the top number is, the better. And, again, if we can just use a little bit of a criteria, if you look at the 120 over 80, that's kind of where things are. But the range could be a little above or a little below that which still could be in the normal range, depending on someone's state of health and the other factors that they have going on. But the things you're doing, you know, you're in beautiful LA, you know, the walking, and again, your availability to fresh produce, I would think, probably organic produce, fruits, and again, I don't know if you're a vegetarian or not, Mark, but indeed, you know, there are a lot of good health things that we can do to try to keep this body as healthy as possible.
Steve from Corvallis, Oregon. Yeah. No, you did. Steve coming in from Corvallis, Oregon, basically saying, is there a difference between reduced fat and fat-free products? That's a great...
Yeah, great question. And, you know, depends on what you're looking at and where you're looking at. Again, who's trying to go ahead and sell a certain product? You know, at one time, you know, we look at milk now. You know that. We look at skim milk or fat-free milk. Then we have the 2%. Then the normal fat in milk is 3.5%. So that overall, the 2% is reduced. The skim milk is fat-free. So with several other products, they do that. But, again, you have to read the label. And you have, because, again, the FDA has several different definitions for these things. So it's something you have to be a good consumer, but you have to be a little bit educated as to what this is saying to us, okay? And I believe the philosophy that we're after with that, Mark, is to go ahead and try to introduce as little fat in our body that we need, all right? You know, we all like to be very bright, our brain working well. We do need certain amount of fats in our circulation to help the brain. So, again, you know, it's not that we went completely 100% fat-free. We do need some fats. So, again, read the labels. And, you know, if you look at most labeling of foods, they'll use the disclaimer, this is based on a 2,000-calorie diet. Have you ever seen that?
Yes, yes.
All right. And now, again, those percentages are based on that 2,000 calorie. Well, what if, you know, your intake is more? What if your intake is less? The dynamics change of this, Mark. So it's not like one size fits all. It's a matter of, again, getting a little bit educated, seeing what your body needs, discussing it with either your dietitian, your healthcare professional, to see what fits for your body. And I don't mean to avoid a hard, fast answer, but again, realize there's a lot of dynamics that goes on with this labeling.
Yeah, Eddie from Roxbury, Mass, chiming in, basically piggybacking that, said he drinks a lot of almond milk. Almond milk is good. And any thoughts on, he kind of grew up a little with eggnog. Any thoughts on that?
I do, if you'd like me to continue here. You know, now again, almond milk. Almond milk is non-dairy. It's non-cow's milk. Now, almond milk does come in a variety of preparations, from zero sugars to a variety of sugar, so that you can get, you know, again, we want to try to avoid sugar if we can, but indeed, the almond milk is good for you. And again, it's non-dairy. And again, you have a certain amount of sugar in there that overall, if you're diabetic, you need to go probably with a lower percentage of sugar in the almond milk. And hopefully you're not allergic to almonds or peanuts, because there is some cross-reactivity, you know, with peanut products and almonds. But that's another story. The other issue is eggnog. Now, eggnog, and again, Mark, these are very, very generic questions. There's an awful lot of sugar in eggnog, all right? And it can vary from about 35 grams to 50, you know, per 8 ounces. So you need to look at that label and then look at, do they have saturated or unsaturated fats? So it is something that overall you can have eggnog. However, it's not something one should have on a regular basis as a beverage. It's like, you know, drinking Coke or Pepsi or having milkshakes all the time. Occasionally it's not bad, but indeed that's kind of something that has a lot of things in that may not be as healthy for our body that it should be, okay?
Yeah, that's a great one right there, and you're bringing up some interesting points with what's going on, you know, with either health or retainers or the head and neck injuries and stuff like that. And, you know, Bill coming in, and I'll take this and I'll give you back the floor from Bellingham, Washington,
sure.
Says, that's why it's very important to protect your head when you ride a bike. I slipped one day without a helmet, and then I thought to myself, I could have hit the curb, and who knows what I have. I always wear my helmet when I ride a bike.
Wow, I think that's smart. I think, you know, again, as far as protecting oneself when doing even recreational activities, you know, I think it's so important. And again, now, you know, we have laws with regard to that, with regard
right.
to using helmets, knee pads, as well as elbow pads in protecting our bodies, especially children. You know, and again, you get into the car seat thing with respect to children and protecting them in our vehicles. So I think, you know, Mark, just reflecting on that, we talk about micromanagement. If I can go back to that point, I think the government does try to help make our lives as healthy as possible in many aspects. And again, it might be micromanagement to talk about car seats, helmets, elbow pads, knee pads. But again, there are some people, as you know, don't have a lot of common sense when it comes to doing things. And so that maybe we help protect them so indeed they don't run into danger. Does that help answer that question, Mark?
I think it does, man. You know, we're talking about head and neck, you know, injuries, infections, and everything. And boy, that's right on up our alley.
Thank you. Mark, you know, and we can take some more questions, but what I wanted to talk about, you know, I think one of the things that I've been seeing recently, you know, Mark, with the weather changing, especially here in the Northeast, you know, people, you know, again, school of course has started, colleges have started, we're indoors more now, you have the heat on, and again, you know, you have a lot of circulation of different things in the air. We're seeing something, again, not a frequent finding, but something called epiglottitis. And epiglottitis is an head and neck infection that infects the voice box. And, you know, as far as our anatomy, we have our mouth, and then we have the throat, and then we kind of break into two tubes. We have the swallow tube, which is called the esophagus, but right in front of that, we have the breathing tube. The breathing tube is, again, carries the air to our lungs. Right at the top of that, we have our vocal cords, and then there's a little trap door structure called the epiglottis. The epiglottis is a structure that when we go to swallow, the epiglottis falls backward to prevent food or liquid from coming into the trachea. Well, there, and again, very, very important, very a structure that, again, we need to take care of. And having said that, being in an environment, if you're around sick individuals, nursing homes, even working in the hospital, that overall you're exposed to bacteria as well as virus. The other thing is people that work around hot chemicals or hot aerosolized chemicals can also get damaged to this epiglottis. And what happens is that overall, this trap door is what we call it, this flap of tissue that protects the voice box as well as the trachea swells, which can be very, very dangerous. Mark, as it swells, it becomes almost very life-threatening that you can't breathe. And how I get involved in this is, you know, I just had a case about 2 weeks ago. We had a 54-year-old gentleman come in, couldn't breathe, was afraid to even talk. He couldn't swallow. And interestingly, when you go see these patients, he was in a very unusual position. And that position being, he's leaning forward. He's on the litter, leaning forward. Saliva is drooling out of his mouth. He's afraid to move. And, you know, when you have something like that, you realize we're in serious trouble. And, you know, today we tried to be very diagnostic, Mark. You know, CT scans, we have scopes, we have x-rays, we have blood tests. Well, when someone comes like this into the hospital, into the emergency room, they have been on the ambulance coming in. There's no time to go ahead and start saying, let's get a CAT scan, let's get blood work, let's CT his throat. Either you know or you don't know what the heck is going on. And indeed, the first thing you want to do, that one wants to do as a provider, is to save this man's life. And an interesting clinical finding, you know, if you go gently to lay this patient back, the guy will fight you. He can't breathe. All right?
Right.
He cannot lay back. And indeed, like I'm saying, he's in, they call that a tripod position, where he's leaning forward, saliva's coming out of his mouth, and he feels like he's dying. And that patient requires immediate attention. And again, just quickly, what we do with that, it's one of two things. If it's something that we have the staff available, he may require something called intubation, where we have a breathing tube, and usually it's part of our team in the emergency room or our anesthesiologist that will go ahead and try to lie him back a bit and then very quickly insert a tube in his voice box. And at that point, the breathing is maintained, the patient is sedated, IV antibiotics are given, and then, of course, the patient goes to the intensive care unit. And the other issue that could occur, if for some reason that patient is having difficulty cooperating with our anesthesia people, with the emergency room people, and he really is having difficulty and struggling, then usually the next step would be to do a tracheostomy or a cricothyrotomy. And that means overall making an opening below his voice box into the trachea and then putting a tube in there to allow him to breathe. So it is something, you know, urgency, we do see it. And it is something that's one of those head and neck emergencies that either you know or you don't know. And if you don't know, your patient's going to die. So it's something that we want to be prepared for. And again, have our staff prepared and trained to take care of this. Going along with that, there's an entity that's similar but not the same. And this is called angioedema. This is where someone who has been taking certain medications, and this usually occurs in our more elderly population in our 50s and 60s, where their body is starting to swell, where overall the lips, the mouth, the throat, the epiglottic area tends to swell, and again, these people cannot breathe. And, you know, there's something called ACE inhibitors, which are medications for cardiovascular problems and heart problems that can be the factor that causes this swelling. And when this patient comes in, and typically they come in via the emergency room with the ambulance, because their family sees them swelling, they're not breathing, the talking goes away, they bring them in. And again, that situation is something that's a little different than the epiglottitis. The patient with this angioedema were able to go ahead, even though they're sitting upright. You know, they start to drool a wee little bit, but interestingly, you can lay them back a little bit more on the litter, and they still can breathe. So we don't have to get the knife out to open up the trachea. We usually, if serious and they're having difficulty, we can intubate, but there's also certain medications we can give that patient to help resolve this without being surgically aggressive. And those are the two things I kind of wanted to talk about that, you know, again, with people being more closed up as we're getting into the fall, the winter, school, you know, the epiglottitis, which is a bacterial infection of the epiglottis, and it can be viral as well, can be very, very serious. And if our patients notice themselves or a family member starting to have difficulty with breathing, there's difficulty swallowing, and they're having even difficulty producing speech, let's not piddle around. Get them to the emergency room, usually via ambulance, if that's at all possible. Mark, that's kind of the gist of what I had to talk about today. So I'd like to go on. If you have a few more questions for me, let's go ahead and expand that.
Yep, Joe coming in from Bucks County, Pennsylvania, he listens quite a bit when he has time, basically says, well, you know, with all these high blood pressure and checking your cholesterol, we're talking about CAT scans, doing the chalk stuff, seeing the inside of your body. What aren't we looking at, or what basically can tell us that we don't have clogged arteries if we're doing all this? Yeah, that's an interesting question.
Very good question. Very interesting. You know, as far as the biggest thing, the words we use are symptoms. You know, for the most part, is anyone having chest pain, chest tightness? Are they having numbness? You know, are they notice their memory's changing? Are they able to do what they once did? So that, you know, that's more of the acute scenario. So that if you notice a change in your bodily function, then you need to look at it. And, you know, when we're looking at our body, we just, as a physician or a provider, you can't see what the cholesterol is. So, you know, it's a matter that you go ahead and you're doing testing. And that's how the problem is really diagnosed, and then you attempt to solve it as a physician. And, you know, we talk about, and I'll review here just a little bit, we talk about the four pillars of medical care. You know, the first pillar is symptoms. You know, what is our chief complaint? What's bothering us? You know, what's the history of the chief complaint? Yeah, I've been having a problem with X, Y, and Z for about a week now, and my right arm is getting weaker and weaker. I drop things, and my vision's changing. You know, and then we have the past medical history, which is part of the first pillar, is that, well, you know what? I had a problem with my carotid artery in the past, and my artery was cleaned. I did well, but I'm seeing those symptoms come back. So that's the first thing. You know, the second thing is physical examination. You know, we have our providers look at us. Let's check our strength. Let's check for numbness. Let's take a listen to those arteries. All right, let's do a physical examination here to see if we can find any clues as to where we need to go. The third pillar, of course, diagnostic testing. Do I need a carotid ultrasound? Do I need an echocardiogram? You know, do I need a CAT scan? Do I need blood work? You know, what is my cholesterol? What are my triglycerides? You know, do I have some type of a urinary infection? And then gathering all that information goes into our fourth pillar, which is the decision making. What do we do to help this patient? But we try to make that decision with good information. And that's kind of how, you know, I think most of our providers attack health problems and patient problems. So I'm not sure I'm answering the question directly, but indeed, nobody can look at you, Joe, and say you have high cholesterol.
Yeah.
You need to be looked at. And right, the other thing is periodic maintenance. Car to the garage and change the oil every 3,000 or 5,000 or 7,000 miles. And then that might be every quarter, or every two quarters, whatever. But indeed, we need to maybe have a little more maintenance on our body. Seeing a provider, getting annual blood work, getting an annual cardiogram or a chest x-ray, whatever seems appropriate to what your health care needs are. But it's hard to do it on your own, and that's what we have healthcare professionals for. Does that help, Mark?
You clarified that perfect. Peter coming in from Mesa, Arizona, listening to the show, and he says with the neck infections, how do we know that we have an infection in our neck? Sometimes we can be strained. Sometimes we can be sleeping the wrong way. I know on my head if I get a bump, I want to check it out. But what would be the indications of something going wrong with my neck?
Sure.
Wow.
You know, when we talk, thank you. Yeah, very nice question. And again, a very broad question. You know, if we talk about a neck, now when we talk in the ear, nose, and throat world, we talk about head and neck infections, head and neck cancers, that overall we're not referring to the spinal column. Usually with ENT, we talk about the trachea, the breathing tube, the soft tissues of the neck, the thyroid, the parotid gland, the lymph nodes, the tonsils. That's the neck that we're talking about. You know, if you have, again, just in general, if we define the word infection, typically infection is an inflammatory process, you know, a process that has a lot of circulation, bringing a lot of cells into the fight. And that's why we see some swelling. And, you know, as far as temperature, temperature is part of it. So you may have an increased temperature. You may have swelling. You may have pus, you know, on a certain area. And again, just to be very simple with it, if it's a tonsillar infection, you know, when we look in there, we may see the tonsils are red, they're swollen, there's exudate or pus on them. There's also lymph nodes in the neck that are swollen, and there may be a temperature. So if one has, say, that triad of findings, you know, temperature, redness, swelling, you have an infection. Usually short of that, yes, you may have, you know, a vertebrae is out. You may need to have them realigned. But again, it's not an infection. Infection usually is caused by bacteria, by fungus, by virus. So there are a triad of things that can cause a problem. But not everything that seems to malfunction is an infection. So again, I'm trying to clarify it, but it's kind of a very, very big topic. Go ahead, Mark.
Jerry from Mankato, Minnesota, coming in, and with the ear, nose, and throat, he said you've helped him out quite a bit with the ears, the wax, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Now with fall coming around, is this the season not only for flus, but allergies and everything?
Very, very good question. And, you know, the answer to the question is yes. With regard to, if we talk about allergy, you know, we use the word allergy for a certain set of symptoms. Usually, again, if I can review here a little bit, itchy, watery eyes, nasal congestion, nasal polyps, postnasal drip, shortness of breath, having rashes, having hives. That's usually allergy symptoms. You're going into the winter. Now, again, if we're talking about the Northeast here, where we have the four seasons, there are wintertime allergies. The wintertime allergies are something called dust mites and mold spores. Dust mites are small little microscopic bugs that we all have. They're in our mattress, they're in our pillows, they're in our bedding, our carpeting, our draperies. Everybody has them. What we have our patients do is mite prevention, and mite is spelled M-I-T-E. You know, either they go ahead, change pillows once a year, get hypoallergenic pillows. They vacuum their mattress maybe once every 2 weeks or so. You can buy then mite-proof covers for the mattress, for the pillows, so that overall you have less exposure. And, you know, we talked about the bedding here a little bit because most of us spend maybe 4, 6, 8 hours in bed. So it is a place that if you have mites, you may have a lot of exposure, especially if you're sensitive, and then wake up with morning allergies. The other situation is mold. And we see that, again, here in Pennsylvania and the Northeast. You know, the leaves are falling. It's wet. And then we have the molds growing on the surface of the leaves on the ground. Molds that you think, yeah, your bathroom, you can have it, or in your basement. But the issue there are spores, that the mold organism produces spores. Spores are little round microscopic balls that go ahead and get into the air. And when they're aerosolized, you breathe them in, they go in your nose, they go in your throat, they touch your skin. So that overall they can give you a variety of symptoms. But in summary, the winter allergies have to do with mold and have to do with dust mites. You know, as we get through the winter, then we get back into our spring allergies, which are the trees, tree pollens, the grasses. And then, you know, the summer is kind of a stability of all that. And then we start going in the fall, which is the ragweed and the ragweed pollens. So that we do have four seasons of allergies in the Northwest here. And I'll be honest, that keeps the allergist very, very busy in this part of the country. So, Mark, that's a long-winded answer.
No,
that's
Marjorie coming in from Sparks, Nevada, first-time listener through some friends. And thank you, Marjorie, for chiming in and listening to the Doc Talk podcast out of Pittsburgh with Dr. Greg Roscoe. She basically says, you know, it's funny because the allergies also kick back up when the springtime gets going around. But she said with the allergy she gets or stuff, it's when she does her cleaning, you know, when you dust some frames or you dust the TV and the dust starts flying, that's where allergies can come in too, correct? Wow.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, she's in a different part of the country, I believe. You mentioned Arizona. Besides the dust, there are a different family of pollens that are in Arizona as opposed to, you know, the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, New York area. As, again, with Florida and, again, with North and South Carolina, et cetera, it's a different pollen factory up here. But, again, dust, for the most part, can have a variety of materials in it. You know, who knows what toxic elements are coming from the air conditioning, the furnace, that may settle on a picture frame. You know, Mark, with regard to referring everything to allergy, sometimes it's not allergy. You know, allergy, just in general, we use the words IgE mediated reaction. IgE is a chemical in our body. If one has high levels of IgE, then they're probably allergic to many, many things. The other element that can give us similar symptoms are toxic elements or irritants. So that if she's dusting, and again, she's probably a very clean woman, but if she is dusting and aerosolizing some toxic elements, she may be breathing them in, And this, of course, irritates our nasal lining. And then what does it do? It starts the inflammatory response, which is the swelling, the mucus, the sneezing. So she could have, you know, non-allergic rhinitis, which is the non-allergy form of, you know, congestion, as opposed to, you know, having IgE-mediated disease. And again, long story short, she may need to see her healthcare professional if it tends to be a nuisance, it's a problem, she needs to take medication, she's not feeling good from it, then maybe she needs to be diagnosed a little to get the right treatment for the right disease. Okay?
Yeah, I think you hit it right on the thing, and you're right. We don't even think of those things till we dust, and then we start sneezing, and, you know, we're dusting the furniture, we're spraying stuff, we're cleaning the restroom and stuff like that. And,
yeah.
You know, there's a lot of things where the dust is flying if you don't take care of it and you let it sit for months. Even the bathtub, somebody's saying.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing what we are exposed to today. You know, we have so many cleaning products, you know, again, and hopefully we have good filters on our furnaces, our air conditioning, to help go ahead and clean the elements of our lives. And, you know, Mark, I tell some of my patients, if they're really very, very sensitive, let's try to make one room in your house a safe room, meaning let's get rid of the carpet, hardwood floors.
Right.
Let's make sure you have a new mattress. Let's make sure maybe you have mic covers. Let's make sure you have hypoallergenic pillows. Let's get an air cleaner in that bedroom. You know, let's not have any plants in the bedroom. So let's make it a safe room, meaning non-allergenic as possible, so your immune system can rest. So go ahead, Mark.
Well, David, coming in from Sioux Falls said, maybe you want to call Molly Maid and keep that place uptight every week so you don't have to get allergies.
Well, I don't think he's wrong.
That's the thing. I know, you know, just a comment on that. I noticed that, and I'm sure a lot of listeners can side with this too, Doc, that when you neglect it and when you don't, you know, dust, you know, you get in a routine and you clean, and then there's some things, you know, if you neglect, that's a buildup, and that buildup you might not get to for a month or so, and that's where the dust would sit on the frames and stuff, and then when you finally come in there to blow that thing, now it just goes all over like a wizard can.
Well, I can't disagree with that, Mark. And, you know, as far as if we can, again, repeat a common theme, it's called maintenance. Our environment that we live in, we need to maintain it as well as we maintain our body organism. So that, you know, with regard to how we live, we need to try to keep that environment as safe as possible. And it does take work. You know that. There's nothing without effort here. And, you know, do you need to clean weekly? Well, that's usually the routine. If you let it go for a month, then again, as you can expect, there'd be a variety of other things going on, and the volume of dust would increase.
Well, as we wrap this thing up with 5 minutes and some change left, give us a recap on the head and neck infections that could cause death and what we're looking at next week, Doc.
Sure. You know, as far as what today, and again, from a situation that we have seen occurring in our emergency rooms, are the head and neck infections that can actually, you know, cause death. And that sounds pretty strong language. But indeed, you know, airway management problems could be very, very serious for our patients. And we know the airway is from the mouth, the throat, the voice box, that, you know, overall, when there is an impingement in that area, it can lead to serious consequences. And the words that I use today were epiglottitis. And that's that small flap that protects our airway from aspiration. So epiglottitis is one. You know, the other one we talk about is angioedema, where the tissues swell due to increased fluid. And that anatomical site can vary from the lips to the tongue to the throat to the vocal cords, that the airway can be compromised because of the swelling. These are rare occurrences, but dangerous occurrences. And it is something, you know, as far as a message to our patients and our listeners, when you start to notice difficulties, especially with your breathing, with your voice or phonation, and you're having difficulty swallowing, something is going on in your upper airway. You know, another corollary to this is something called quinsy. Quinsy, it's an old name for a disease that's called a peritonsillar abscess. Along with this head and neck infection process, if one has bad tonsils, they then get a very serious infection behind the tonsil. And actually, you have bacteria living between the tonsil and the muscles of the throat. Pus is building up there, actually pushing the tonsil into the airway, causing obstruction. And again, very serious symptom, airway impingement, shortness of breath, pain, and again, one may have the signs of infection, a temperature, neck swelling, pus in the throat. And again, these are situations we need to get you to a healthcare facility and to start give you some treatment. And again, it's the four pillars. They want to know the history. They want to examine you. They may do some diagnostic testing. Then we're able to treat. And all these problems are not the same. So we need our experienced practitioners to help protect your life and to save your life overall. Mark, and that's kind of the gist of what I wanted to talk about today. Do you have anything else for me to finish up?
Well, no, and I can't wait for next week. We possibly could have former speedster and World Series champ from the Oakland A's, Bill North, on.
Yes, and, you know, along our series of talking about smokeless tobacco in the professionals, and that's football and baseball, that overall, over the years, you know, it's become a real culture with chewing tobacco. And again, we do know that a very famous athlete, Tony Gwynn, did die from oral cancer, head and neck cancer, because of smokeless tobacco. And we've had several professionals on talking about it. And Mark Mancini has made a great contact for us with Bill North to help talk about, again, smokeless tobacco in the majors, to see what that's going, and again, what's being done to help our young people. And I think, Mark, you know, we do use our athletes as role models. How many young men look at these guys and say, I want to be like that. I want to be successful like that. I want to spit like that. You know, it's a variety of things, but would like to make sure their lives are good, they're healthy, and they can enjoy the fruits of all the work that they've done and not have an oral cancer requiring radiation or heavy-duty surgery. So that would be
exactly
next week. And then, yeah, just to finish up, Mark, down the road just a little bit, we have a few guests coming on. And, you know, we've talked about disease and about infections. We've talked about cancers and, you know, the four pillars. We're also going to have on a gentleman by the name of Dr. Gene Myers. And we're going to talk about how does he, and he's been a residency doctor to train ear, nose, and throat head and neck surgeons. And we're going to have him on to talk about how he's done that, how he's prepared them, and what his philosophy in training residents has been. We also have a CEO of a large hospital chain that acquires hospitals, especially here in Western Pennsylvania, to talk about their mission and their thoughts about access of health care, getting services. What is their mission and what are their goals in health care? So I thought it would be a little change of events having these two gentlemen on to help talk about health care as well.
Yeah. And how can people get a hold of you as we wrap this great show up, Doc?
Surely. My email, gjrmd308@outlook.com. And again, we get an awful lot of emails. We do try to answer them. My staff is very good with regard to helping with all this. And again, I'd like to thank my research staff as well, helping to put together the topics, help answering these questions. And we want to make the program very useful for our listeners. And I want to thank you and Mancini Media as well, Mark.
Yeah, I love doing this each and every week. Can't wait to do it next week. And if anybody has missed the show or you want to pass it to friends, blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports Podcast Platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcasts, powered now by Mancini Media. So for Dr. Greg Roscoe out there in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, yours truly, Mark Mancini, producing in Los Angeles. Have a great day, safe weekend. We'll talk to you next week, same time, same channel, with Bill North.
Thank you very much.